This podcast is brought to you by AJ Bell and Shares Magazine. Shares Magazine is published by AJ Bell Media, part of AJ Bell.
Hi there, my name's Dan Coatsworth. Welcome to our third podcast dedicated to investment trust. Now, this is a bonus podcast that runs once a month alongside the normal weekly AJ Bell Money and Markets show. Joining me this week is Laith Calaf.
Thanks, Dan. Yes, in this special podcast, we discuss hot topics with a range of investment experts with some educational content to help listeners get up to speed if they're not familiar with investment trusts. In today's episode, we're going to be debating one of the most popular investment trusts on the market.
That's right. We've got JP Morgan Global Growth and Income. Now, that's fast becoming a big favourite with investors. So we've got Martin Gamble and Tom Sieber from Shares Magazine on the show to give us some insight into why it's doing so well.
And I'll be talking to Annabel Brody-Smith from the Association of Investment Companies about dividend heroes in the investment trust space. We'll also be hearing from Ryan Lightfoot-Aminoff from Kepler Partners about options for investing in the UK following proposals announced by the government to launch a British ISA.
Now, later in the show, I'll be talking to James Smith from Premier Miton about why the renewable energy space has been a disappointing place for investors recently, and what's needed for the sector to deliver better returns. First up, we're going to take a look at a couple of bits of news I thought was really catching in the investment trust space. First of which is that activist investor Elliott has taken a small stake in Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust. So this is quite significant. Scottish Mortgage historically has traded above the value of its assets, but over the last couple of years, its sort of growth angle has gone quite out of favour, particularly with companies that have unquoted companies, I should say, you know, so invested in companies that aren't on the stock market. Now, you know, as interest rates have gone up, these have definitely gone out of favour. So Scottish Mortgage at the moment is trading on a discount to the value of its underlying portfolio. So ultimately, Elliott's come in and you know, whilst it's not issued a formal statement at the time of recording this podcast about what it wants to do, it's pretty obvious he wants that valuation gap to narrow. Now, naturally, there's a couple of ways it could do that. First is for Scottish Mortgage to buy back more shares. And actually, just a few days before it made this announcement that Elliott had taken a stake, it announced a £1 billion buyback, which is really significant. It's about 9% of the value of the trust at the time of the news. So I would have thought, first of all, we've got speculation that Elliott, he might have seen Elliott building a stake, and then he thought, okay, well, let's get in there quick. Let's announce this buyback before Elliott starts putting pressure on us to do this. Another thing it could do is to reduce the number of unquoted companies in its portfolio. And there is some speculation just over the last few days that it might actually be able to sell some of those investments for more than they're currently sort of sitting in terms of book value in its account. So things like investing in flying taxis, 3D printed rockets, perhaps some of these sort of wacky ideas it might sort of scale back on. But anyway, it's incredibly popular trust. If you didn't hear last week's podcast, we had one of the managers of Scottish Mortgage on talking about what they're trying to do. So obviously we'll come back to this story as it evolves. But the other thing I want to talk to you, and we'll bring Tom Sieber now onto the show from Shares Magazine, to talk about regional REITs. So Tom, what exactly has been going on there?
Yeah, hi Dan. So to give you a bit of background on Regional REIT, it's a Glasgow headquartered investor in regional offices. And I actually met the management of this REIT back in 2019. And they talked about how they'd been taking advantage of how few commercial buildings had been built outside of London in the wake of the financial crisis. And their focus seemed to be not on kind of flashy new buildings, but on refurbishing existing ones, which could be acquired more cheaply, perhaps because they were in slightly less central locations in towns and cities, even if they were still fundamentally sort of decent buildings. And that was a strategy that, for a time, appeared to be serving it quite well in a pre-pandemic world. But as with much of the commercial property universe, COVID has had a huge and lasting impact on the group. So you've obviously had this move towards hybrid working, a need on the part of employers to offer more attractive working spaces to actually get people into the office in the first place. And arguably that left regional REITs portfolio perhaps not looking as well positioned as it had done previously. If you look at the latest updates from the company, the situation on the ground has probably improved a little bit. So occupancy has gone up. Rent collection has been pretty decent. So they've been able to, they've got decent tenants that are paying their rent on time and in full. But negative sentiment towards the portfolio is reflected in the fact that it trades at a near 80% discount, if you look at the latest data from the Association of Investment Companies. So it's clearly out of favour with investors. And what's kind of compounded things more recently is all of the impact of the pandemic has put a lot of pressure on their balance sheet, and the company has scaled back its dividend, it's sold off some assets. But even when you take into account these measures, it's facing a maturity on a £50 million retail bond, which is due in August 2024, and it urgently needs to refinance this, basically roll it over. The company is weighing its options, but it did respond to some media speculation on the 12th of March, saying it would raise funds at a big discount to address this looming debt. And I think apart from, you know, the wider issue of kind of it being over leveraged, the question is how good a job the company did of kind of communicating to shareholders that it was perhaps in this position, because it did flag it was looking at a range of financing options for this maturing bond. But the announcement on the 12th of March clearly came as a massive shock to the market, because the shares were marked down 30% on the day. So, you know, they're in a difficult position, partly through, you know, their own making, but also through the wider environment. But they probably haven't done a great job of kind of managing expectations in the market either.
Okay, thanks, Tom. Now let's turn our attention to the proposed launch of the British ISA. It's been pretty controversial, to say the least, but the government is planning to let investors have an additional £5,000 on top of the usual £20,000 ISA allowance, but only for investments made in UK assets. Now, this British ISA is still subject to industry consultation, but a lot of people do think it could create more interest in the UK stock market. So we thought it would be useful to call upon an expert to talk about the opportunities available among UK investment trusts.
Yeah, so let's bring on Ryan Lightfoot-Aminoff, who's an investment trust research analyst at Kepler. So Ryan, thanks for joining us. So what exactly is on offer from investment trusts in terms of UK exposure?
I think we're quite spoiled in the UK with the amount of asset classes and structures that are available with investment trusts. We have everything from sort of small cap equities through to things really esoteric like forestry and wind farms. And this gives investors access to a really diverse range of different asset classes, each of which will have their own performance drivers and ideal environments. That means their performance will sort of occur at different periods, doing different things and at different times. And the close-end structure of investment trusts lends themselves really well to less liquid asset classes as well, like private equity or micro caps or property, because these have often been difficult areas for investors to get exposure to. And there have been some problems with some of these asset classes in different structures. So the investment trust universe lends itself really well to that. And I think the UK market itself also lends itself quite well to investment trusts, because the UK market is sort of more income orientated than other global peers, and investment trusts have a structure that works quite well for this. They can use things called income reserves, which allows them to hold back a bit of income in the good times to build up a buffer, which can be deployed at times of weakness. For example, during the COVID pandemic, where lots of firms cut or suspended dividends, lots of investment trusts had built up these revenue reserves, meaning they're able to continue to pay great income out to their shareholders. So all in all, I think investment trust world has a really diverse range of assets and characteristics, which helps investors construct a well-balanced portfolio from across the UK and bring out all of the capabilities that we have in the wide UK investing scene.
So in your opinion, which UK-focused investment trusts stand out from the crowd, and perhaps why?
Yeah, I think something like Aberforth, UK smaller companies, is potentially one of those. It's run by a seven strong team of managers. The structure's been in place since around the early 90s. So really good, repeatable process that has shown ability to outperform markets in a number of conditions. And the trust itself is a value-orientated smaller companies trust. So that style has been out of favour for a few years, but has really come back in and when that style has come in, it's got that tailwind. It's really delivered on it. So not only has it held up in the times where it's still somewhat out of favor, but when it is in favor, it's done really well. And we think that's a testament to the quality of the process. And then looking at it, why it should be attractive right now, they are saying they're on a quadruple discount. So not only is the UK cheap versus global markets, the trust itself is at a discount, as most UK smaller companies' trusts are, but also smaller companies themselves are very cheap versus large companies because of concerns over recession. And then the managers themselves have that value orientated approach, meaning that their portfolio is cheaper than the average of the benchmark. So if you were to have all of those things combined, of the UK perhaps having a turnaround, smaller companies perhaps coming back as the economy does, discount narrowing, and the investment style being recognised more in favour, there's an awful lot of catalysts to really drive the performance of that trust.
I think if someone's new to investing, where would be the logical place for them to start with UK-focused investment trusts?
So this answer, I think, comes with a bucket load of caveats, as every investor's situation is different. But for those new to investing, I would surmise that they would want something that's towards the lower end of the risk scale, investing in UK-focused investment trusts, and therefore maybe something in the equity income space could be a more suitable place to start. This is because of the income generation that helps with total returns. And there are a number of trusts that have really good revenue reserves as well, touched on earlier, where they've held back some of that income in the good times to support dividends in the weaker periods. So that really helps for more risk-off moments. Now you get that regular income coming in to support total returns. In that space, one that immediately comes to mind is Shires Income. This is run by a couple of managers from Aberdeen, and they take a really diversified approach to the equity income sector. So not only do they have a multi-cap approach, which means that they can have the better growth potential of smaller companies, but also that more stable dividend stalwart area of the larger companies. They can also invest in a little bit of overseas exposure, perhaps where the UK lacks the opportunities that you can get in different countries. And then also they've got this allocation to preference shares. Now, these are special equity instruments that they have a number of bond-like characteristics. So this helps to dampen the volatility of the portfolio and further increase the revenue generation. I think Shires is just a very good example of maximizing all the capabilities of the investment trust structure, and could offer investors a really nice sort of coverall entry point to investing in the area.
I think the UK market has been unloved for quite a long time. Do you think that investors actually might be a bit better off holding a global equity fund or a trust rather than simply putting money into the UK because the government's offering this tax incentive with the sort of the new ISA?
Yeah, well, taking the last bit first, if I may, I think the concept of investing on the basis of a government tax incentive might be putting the cart before the horse somewhat. So that's something to consider. And also the potential of the UK ISA, I think, may have been a little exaggerated, which no doubt we'll come back to later. But there are a number of opportunities investment trusts that can offer both global exposure and the UK exposure. So I think that investors are a bit spoiled for choice in that regard. The UK has obviously been under pressure, as everyone is aware, for quite a prolonged period of time. And that has attracted a lot of negative attention and a lot of negative column inches. But as a result, valuations are really very cheap. UK investment trusts are arguably on that double discount at the moment because broad market valuations are depressed versus their global peers, but also the investment trusts that focus on this space have that discount as well. So if we do start to turn a corner in terms of sentiment and this snaps back, we're potentially looking at double whammy for investors of asset values going up and discounts narrowing. That being said, there are reasons for the UK struggling. The market is underway a number of key sectors that are driving global growth, most notably in the tech sector, which has done very well this year on the back of a very good 2023. So for investors who want to add that to their portfolio, they may wish to look elsewhere. Putting this all together, I mean, there is nothing to say investors only have to hold one trust. They could balance their exposures in a portfolio. So a couple of things that we put together may potentially look at is something like Allianz Tech Trust, because this offers the exposure to that US tech industry that is so in vogue at the moment. The trust itself is actually overweight the mid-cap holdings, so you get some exposure to those off-benchmark positions that could be the next drivers of the growth leg. But it's also trading at a discount at the moment, meaning investors can get exposure to all of those exciting tech growth things at a value below what the net asset value of those companies is. And then we compare this with something like Aberforth UK Smaller Companies. It's a value-orientated, UK-focused smaller companies trust. Because of that, it contrasts very nicely with that Allianz tech exposure, where you've got the growth exposure in the US versus the UK value trend. So blending those two together, you could really capture the strongest growth themes in the globe at a really chunky discount, and then mix that with the undervalued qualities of the UK through something like Aberforth, and it just adds to that diversification of portfolio.
So I guess your statements are implying that actually the UK ISA might not make a big difference to UK demand. But what do you really think is we could see?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think that the UK ISA isn't going to be the silver bullet to the UK's market's problems, but it is at the very least a step in the right direction. There's been some really very good analysis on the impact of what the UK ISA could be, far better than the analysis I could provide. And I think I saw some numbers that if everybody who maximizes their ISA allowance also then maximize their UK ISA allowance and all put it into the UK market in the same proportions and levels than they have done, it would add around 0.1-0.2% to the total market cap of the UK. So it's effectively going to be a rounding error if it all goes to plan. However, it is at least the government acknowledging the problem, which is a really important first step, because the UK market has been slipping back for the best part of a decade now. However, it is at least the government acknowledging that there's a problem with the UK markets. And that's, I think, a really important first step, because the UK market has been slipping back for the best part of a decade now. And there are a number of contributing factors to that, ranging from the sector makeups and the lack of tech that we talked about, through to things like regulations. And this has really diminished the standing of the UK against its global peers. So the potential of some capital input from UK savers won't in itself reverse all of these issues, but it at least demonstrates that the issues are being looked at and that remedial action is starting to be taken. We think that hopefully the starts sort of the next steps of similar rules for things like pension allocations, which is a much bigger pot of capital to put in there. And there's been lots of further noise about changing regulations or listing rules, and it's become a bit of a battleground in the potentially upcoming elections. So we're just really hoping that this at least changes the narrative about the UK stock market, and this starts to bring in overseas investors seeing that the UK is back in business. We are a global financial hub, but we've slipped down the allocations of the global market indices. So I'm really hoping that things like this coming in says to the international community that the UK is actually looking to support its own stock market. Maybe you should too. So while the UK has been out of favour for a while, it's a very cheap market accordingly. And we're potentially seeing some green shoots that might start to indicate some change. And I think the narrative is really beginning to turn the corner in terms of sentiment.
That was Ryan Lightfoot-Aminoff from Kepler. Now let's move on to the world of income, which is such a popular topic with many investors. The Association of Investment Companies publishes a list of trusts that it calls Dividend Heroes. It's a useful place for investors to start their research into income opportunities. Annabel Brodie-Smith is the AIC's Communication Director, and she joins us now. Annabel, thank you so much for sparing the time to come on the podcast. It would be great if we could just kick off by just starting to explain what a dividend hero is and how many there are out there.
There are 20 dividend hero investment trusts, and they are the investment trusts that have increased their dividend every year consecutively for more than 20 years. We have 20 of them, and I have to say they have some really strong long records of dividend growth. So 10 out of those 20 trusts have increased their dividends for over 50 years, consecutively year in, year out. And we have some well-known names like City of London Investment Trust, Bankers Investment Trust, Alliance Trust at the top of the list that all have 57 years of consecutive dividend growth.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty impressive record. How on earth have they achieved this? Because obviously they're invested in the market where they get variable dividends. So can you just explain to us how they've managed to get this sustainable long-term dividend stream?
Yes, it's a real benefit of the investment trust structure. What they can do is they don't have to pay out all of their income every year to their shareholders, which they receive from their investee companies. They can retain up to 15% of the income they receive each year. That goes in their revenue reserve. So they sort of basically keep it in reserve. Then when times are tough, and we know in investment, times do get tough. So perhaps when there's like, for example, the pandemic, when there were a lot of dividend cuts, then they can draw on those revenue reserve to boost their income. So that's how they can smooth those dividends and raise them consecutively year in, year out.
Okay, thank you. And, you know, just looking at the list of the trusts that are dividend heroes, quite a few of them aren't actually income trusts, so they don't have an income mandate. So why, you know, these are trusts like Scottish Mortgage, for instance, which is known as a very well-known growth trust. So why are those trusts paying out such long-term rising dividends?
Well, you're completely right. The trusts are from different sectors. So we've got global trusts, UK smaller companies trusts. First of all, of course, they are meeting their shareholders' needs, and generally shareholders want a combination of capital growth and income. It's a very popular mix, and those shareholders appreciate those rising dividends. In addition to that, I'd say obviously lower yielding trusts, which perhaps aren't in the income sector, often have high dividend growth rates. And you know, investors, you know, you might be a younger investor, you might be happy with a lower yield, but you might appreciate that that yield is growing quickly. So for example, you know, the Global Smaller Companies Trust, it's got a 1.5% yield, it's in global smaller company sector, but it's got a 10% dividend growth rate. So clearly that dividend is growing quickly. So I think investors can really mix and match their trusts to meet their investment needs, whether they're capital or income needs. And as I said, most like a combination of the two.
Okay, well, let's focus for a little minute on those kind of income needs. So let's look specifically at the income funds in the Dividend Heroes list. So those that are trying to deliver income, you know, how have they performed in terms of capital return as well? I mean, is there any indication that, you know, this focus on regular income is maybe damaging the total return provided by those trusts?
Well, actually, it's not that simple, because there's really a mix in terms of that. So let me give you some examples. Let's look at the UK sectors. Now, the UK has obviously had a tough time recently. If we look at the UK equity income sector, and I think it is important to emphasise that's a 4.4% yield you're getting, and that income is very important for many investors. But if we look at the total return, say, over 5 years, it's 22%, it's up 22%. Over 10 years, it's up 65%. If we compare that to the UK all companies sector, which is really focusing on growth, actually the returns are very similar. You know, over 5 years, it's 23% up, so just like 1% difference. Over 10 years, 72% up. So, you know, a very small difference. So really on the UK sectors, you're not seeing that much difference. Interestingly, on the global sectors, with the global equity income sector, where you're getting, again, 3.7 yield, you are seeing more of a difference. So over 5 years, the return is 46%, 10 years, 131%. If you compare that with the global sector, where you're seeing more emphasis on capital returns, then over 5 years, that's at 59%, and over 10 years, 230%. So it does have some impact. But the reality is, for a lot of investors, they're after that income. And they're perfectly happy to have that income, and that consecutive record of dividend rises is actually what they want. They want to sleep well at night and not worry about their income needs.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, I guess just looking at those investors, you know, if you're interested in the Dividend Heroes, obviously they've all got very long-term track records of rising dividends. What other sort of metrics should investors look at when they're sifting through this list if they're interested in it?
Sure. Well, obviously, we always say when looking at investment trusts, you look at the objective of the trust, you see if that meets your investment needs. You would always look at the performance data and the charges and the portfolio. But I think let's have a think about the actual income metrics. Clearly, you'd look at the dividend yield figure. You'd look at the dividend growth, the 5-year dividend growth figure. That will give you an idea of how quickly that dividend is increasing. So you might be one of these investors who wants a high yield and you're happy that that yield grows fairly slowly. Or you might be a young investor who's prepared to take, you know, a lower yield, but you want that growth. And you think, you know, by the time you get to needing that income, the growth, the yield will have increased. That is a very important one. The other one I always recommend is the dividend cover figure. It's the number of years the current revenue reserve will pay the current dividend. And what that gives you is an idea of how reliable that dividend is going forward. If that figure is above one, that means it's got more than 1 year's of reserves to pay the current dividend. And, you know, that means, you know, you've got a lot of income there. And it's a fairly, you know, reliable that it's going to be able to increase very easily. Other data, when we're looking at investment trusts, I always also say that you should look at the discount. You should compare the discount on your potential trust with the sector average, see how it's doing. Question to yourself if it's very, very different. That might be an opportunity, but you do need to ask yourself whether it is. It's not necessarily the case. You need to find out, think about why it's on a wide discount. And I also say, always look at the gearing. How much is that company borrowing? You know, the general rule is, you know, the way gearing works is you borrow to invest. And the idea is that you, over the long term, it sort of magnifies your performance, that gearing. But clearly, if the long-term performance is poor, then it's going to be a drag on your performance.
So that was Annabel Brodie-Smith from AIC. If you'd like more information about investment trusts, AJ Bell's website has stacks of data, or you can go onto the AIC's website, which is theaic.co.uk.
Yes, and JP Morgan Global Growth and Income has been a great performer over the years. We regularly see it on the list of most popular trusts held by AJ Bell customers. To find out the secret of its success, let's bring on Tom and Martin from Shares Magazine.
It promises to offer investors the best of both worlds, in inverted commas, with exposure to quality global businesses along with quarterly dividends. The trust has something of an esoteric past, like many of its counterparts. It was launched in 1887 with a remit of investing in steamships. Today, its mandate is to provide superior total returns and outperform the MSCI All Country World Index over the long term by investing in companies based around the world. Unusually, at the moment, for investment trusts, it trades at a premium. So beyond its headline performance, what has been making JP Morgan Global Income and Growth so popular with investors, Martin?
Yeah, I think the main reason is the balance between income and growth. So it's the consistency of performance as well as the actual quantum of performance. So when interest rates were low before the pandemic, the trust had exposure to growth companies, technology, some of the fastest growing companies around the world. And then when we had the pandemic and then higher interest rates post-pandemic, the trust's exposure to some of the growth, some of the value areas of the markets helped them out. So they seem to be performing well in whatever style is popular at a particular time. And I think that draws investors in because the volatility around that strong performance is lower. So I think it kind of fits more as a all-round weather fund for investors. So that tends to be a big attraction.
Yeah, because I guess, is it perhaps pulling in people who might otherwise have looked at things like Fundsmith, which obviously has been very popular?
Yes, and Fundsmith, of course, has had a poor performance since interest rates have started rising because of its exposure to the growth element only. So I think the more rounded, balanced style approach of this fund definitely gives it some defensive features in different market environments. And of course, we don't know what's going to happen in the next few years. Maybe interest rates will stay high. So this fund tries to find the best companies around the globe and also balance it with some income.
And the charges are relatively attractive, right, as well?
Yes, I think the charges are pretty competitive for a global fund. And also, as the fund, I mean, his recent history is it's been merging different JP Morgan products, and also with the Scottish Investment Trust, it merged. So it's gone from like 1.3 billion to 2.5 billion in a very quick time. And that's allowed the board to lower the fees on the product, which is, again, good news for investors.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think they're 0.5%, which does, as you say, compares pretty favorably with kind of counterpart products. If we look at the portfolio, there are several names which would be pretty familiar to most investors and holdings which would cross over with other global funds. So you've got companies like Microsoft, Amazon, Nvidia, you know, the big AI star at the moment, MasterCard, Coca-Cola, and beloved both of global funds, but also emerging market funds, the chip manufacturer, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, often shortened to TSMC. But there are one or two slightly less familiar names in the portfolio, although they're still very large companies. So you've got United Health, which is a US healthcare insurance and services provider. It's headquartered in Minnesota. It might not be a household name, but it is the world's largest healthcare company by revenue. And interestingly, given the trust's income remit, it has delivered double-digit growth in dividends over a number of years. So that's probably quite relevant to its inclusion in the portfolio. Another name which stands out as perhaps being slightly less familiar is CME Group. This is the company behind several prominent futures and commodity exchanges in the US. Businesses has got very robust margins. And again, it's a company which pays out pretty generous dividends too. Beyond sort of looking kind of broadly at what's in the portfolio, can you talk a little bit more, Martin, about what has underpinned the success of the trust? What's kind of the strategy and what resources can it draw on?
Yeah, sure. Well, they have a three-pronged strategy, really, to find the best businesses wherever they are listed in the world. So the idea is that, you know, different parts, you know, the US has got a lot of strong technology businesses, as we've already mentioned. Japan's got some very good chip companies too, but it tends to be good at the industrial side of things. Yeah. And in Europe, you've got some good luxury good names. So they try and cherry pick the best companies wherever they're listed. And for the fund managers, it's very much a stock picking bottom up approach.
Yeah.
And they're looking for businesses which have strong fundamentals. So they've got high returns on capital. They've got good competitive advantages, which means that they're not a victim to the market cycle or the economic cycle. Their destiny is in their own hands. So that's they're the sort of factors they're looking for, where businesses are not affected by the economic cycle or by competitive threats. So they're looking for strong balance sheets, strong competitive positions. So wherever they can find those businesses, they tend to invest in them. But they have also access to a huge resource in terms of analysts around the world, and they collaborate with the fund managers. So the analysts give insights into some of the best companies that they find, and then the fund managers try and find high conviction ideas around those insights.
That's interesting. I mean, you know, it's the benefits, I suppose, of being part of such a large organization like JP Morgan, that it has that level of resource to draw on, right?
Yeah, exactly. And the analysts, interestingly, are not asked to find companies that are outperform their local benchmarks. Once they have their insights and the fund managers got the conviction that the management's good and sensible asset allocators and the business is strong, what they're looking for is how that's going to impact the portfolio. So it's not, will it outperform the benchmark, the the hurdle, if you like, is much higher. They say, well, that's a great idea, but how will it improve the portfolio we already have? And they argue that's a very much higher bar. And they reckon that on average, only 2-2.5% of ideas that they look at each year make it into the final portfolio. That so that's sense. One of the key strengths behind the consistency of performance. And when it comes to the income side of things, they don't need to dive into some of the more cyclical areas of the market like other income funds do. They're looking for consistency of dividend, not necessarily the amount of income they produce. Because one of the unusual features of this fund or this trust is that it pays a quarterly dividend out of NAV.
Right.
So they're not reliant on income they receive from the dividends the companies pay to pay out dividends to shareholders.
Are there any drawbacks to that potentially? Or
I guess potentially if the income isn't there, they might have to rely on revenue reserves to pay out a dividend.
Yeah.
But I think in recent years, they've managed to increase the dividend by around 8%, which is quite impressive.
Yeah. So it suggests, and they've done that over a number of years. So I suppose it suggests that effectively what they're doing works, at least for in the current environment, it seems to be.
Yeah, and I think it gives investors a lot more comfort that they're going to get the income and it's paid out quarterly at the board's discretion.
Are there any other sort of risks that people need to consider when looking at JGGI?
I think it's there's always a risk that the strategy that you have will not, and everyone knows this, will not perform in every environment.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, this management claim that they do, and they have proven they performed in different environments. But I guess there will be a day when, for whatever reason, it won't perform in a particular environment. But it's hard to kind of speculate what that environment will be.
No,
but so far, they seem to have delivered a very consistent performance.
Thanks, Tom and Martin, for bringing us up to speed with JP Morgan Global Growth and Income. And if there's a particular trust you'd like us to debate on the podcast, we'd love to hear your suggestions. You can email podcast@ajbell.co.uk. Now, we've got quite a few requests already lined up, but please do keep those ideas rolling in.
There's time for one more guest on this episode of the podcast. James Smith is the manager of Premier Miton Global Renewables Trust. He seeks to achieve long-term capital growth and high income from owning shares in companies that operate renewable energy and other sustainable infrastructure assets. So James, I think renewable energy has been a fairly miserable place to invest over the past few years. Why has the sector actually been struggling?
So, you're correct. Dan, I mean, for the past couple of years, it really has been pretty terrible. And I guess the main thing that, you know, one could point to is this kind of major change we've had in the interest rate environment, whereby for the past couple of years, we've been in this very sharply increasing interest rate environment. And for right or wrong, the market often sees renewable energy stocks as being, to use a horrible phrase, bond proxies. And by that, it means that the market assumes that renewable energy companies have rather fixed revenues in the same way that the returns on a bond, the coupons on a bond are fixed. They assume that renewable energy companies are the same. And therefore, if interest rates go up, then the present value of those future cash flows in current day terms is obviously reduced as you discount them back at this higher rate. So I think that's probably the main thing. There's been a few other subsidiary things, such as a perception that governments have gone a bit cool on the sector, although I don't believe that's true if you actually look at the facts. So we've had several things like the Inflation Reduction Act in the States. We've got the EU renewable law that was passed in May last year, whereby they want 42.5% of total energy coming from renewable energy, which is about double where it is at the moment. So they want that by 2030, sorry. And we've seen, of course, last year, the auction for offshore wind in the UK failed. So the government are coming back on that this year, but with a much better sort of maximum bid price for companies to frame their bids. So, you know, I think governments are still very keen on the sector. I think a third thing is underlying power markets have been fairly volatile. So we saw, of course, immediately post the Ukraine war, actually slightly before. So February 2022. So slightly before that, power markets started to go up, and then they hit huge heights in 2022 and going on into last year. And now they've kind of come crashing back down again. So that any renewable energy company that has any exposure to the power markets themselves has seen very volatile earnings. And I think maybe a few investors have thought, well, you know, that's not really what we signed up for. And then I think also just fourthly, there's been this perception that costs are increasing in the sector. So not just interest rate costs or financing costs, but the actual cost of building renewable energy assets. And again, we saw that last year with a company called Ørsted, which you may be familiar with, but that's one of the world's leading offshore renewable energy developers. And they cancelled a number of projects in the States because they sort of fixed their revenues in advance, but their costs hadn't quite been nailed down as they should be. And those costs had increased in the meantime, and it meant those projects were no longer viable. You know, to my mind, that was a project. That was a problem of Ørsted itself. I haven't really noticed that same thing happening to other companies. But yeah, costs have gone up in, say, offshore wind, but they've come down in solar. So, you know, we can go through all of those things. I think largely they're misplaced, but that's kind of the four main reasons that I could point to that the sector's been sort of out of favour, really, over the past couple of years.
Is there also an element of lots of people were looking for income? Go back a few years, some of these renewable energy companies or investment vehicles were paying quite attractive yields. And now, last couple of years, you've been able to get risk-free decent returns from cash. So it's almost like it's removed some of those natural buyers of renewable energy. Is that a factor, or is that not, do you think that's not as a such a big driver of why the sector's been out of favor?
I think that is important. You know, the I guess for all income sectors in the past, when interest rates were on the floor, if you wanted income, you know, higher yield equities were probably the only game in town, really. And now there is this other option that you can just leave it in the bank. So yeah, I think it has impacted at the margin. And we've seen, I think, flows out of maybe some of the multi-asset income funds. And those funds would be natural holders of many of the UK renewable energy names, for instance. So certainly that has been a factor. I mean, to my mind, it doesn't really make sense, again, because if you look at the underlying cash flows of most renewable energy companies, there's a high degree of inflation linkage in there. And that means dividends are also quite well linked to inflation. Whereas, of course, if you have your money in the bank, it certainly is not. So short-term may be a factor. But I think long-term, if people want an income that keeps up with inflation, obviously, you know, the bank isn't going to cut it, really.
Yeah, I mean, the idea, if you talk to the average member of the public, or you talk to a politician, everyone seems to be in favour of renewable energy. But if you actually see what's happening, you know, real commitments by governments, commitments by corporates or consumers saying, yeah, I'm going to switch my sort of utility provider to get renewable energy, it doesn't quite seem like people are sort of that as motivated, perhaps, as they were sort of, I don't know, 3-4 years ago. Do you think that's correct? Is it all a lot of talk and not enough action, really?
I think when you're looking at the residential sector, the primary concern of any buyer of electricity, or, you know, someone looking at their household bills, is price. So I think that's the main motivator, although some people may opt for renewable energy tariffs. We have to remember, though, that most electricity is not consumed by domestic residences. It's consumed by industrials and companies and businesses. And actually, I would say the opposite is true, that we've seen a strong demand for renewable power. And I mentioned earlier on that the power prices have been very volatile over the past couple of years. So a number of companies have seen their energy bills really shoot up. Now, the beauty of renewable energy is that the costs of renewable energy really are largely fixed. So you're looking at the amortization of the actual cost of building it in the first place. So you write off the cost of the wind turbine over 30 years, and you're also looking at the finance cost as well. But the point is that you fix all those in advance. So the finance costs would also be fixed for the long term. So what we see is that when companies are building a renewable energy asset and a wind farm or whatever, they find a ready stream of corporate buyers actively looking to take that power for 10 or 20 years, whatever it is. So most renewable energy installations now will have a buyer sort of signed up before they actually put a spade in the ground or a foundation in the North Sea. They will know who's going to take that power for the next 10, 15, sometimes longer years. So corporate certainly not going cool on it. And in fact, I think that's increasing. So another big sector, for instance, would be data centers, artificial intelligence. Of course, that will consume a lot more power. And we're seeing a lot of that now being built in the States, for instance, and it will come to Europe as well. And the companies building those, they want to be seen to be using renewable energy. They don't want to be seen to be building all this energy-intensive infrastructure that's reliant on fossil fuels. So we're actually seeing demand, I think, being quite strong. So, I guess long, short answer is it depends what sector you're looking at. But overall, yeah, it's still, the demand is still there.
Yeah. So obviously, if investor sentiment towards the sector is perhaps not very good at the moment, but the outlook is that interest rates might start to come down. So if interest rates going up have been sort of a headwind, could this now be sort of a tailwind for the sector if interest rates are cut? And if so, obviously, is this quite a good time to go looking for, renewable and energy investments across the board, whether it's an investment company, investment trust? Go look for some bargains, do you think?
All I can say is, every fund manager is always very positive on their own portfolio. But I look at, after 2 years of fairly poor performance of the sector, I look at the companies I invest in, and they by and large, are trading on multiples, which I wouldn't have guessed they would have done if you'd asked me a couple of years ago. So, I think there's a lot of value out there. And in the same way that interest rates have been a headwind, on the past couple of years, they could well turn into a tailwind for the next couple of years. And it has surprised me, actually. I've spent some time plotting the share prices of some of the UK renewable energy companies, the investment companies like Greencoat or Bluefield Solar, et cetera, and if you plot them against 10-year bond yields, looking at an inverse 10-year bond yield, for instance, you will see that the share prices are remarkably correlated to yields. So if that relationship continues to hold, then interest rates going back down should lead to share prices going back up. But of course, who knows? That's what history would indicate is likely to happen. I hope it does, but we'll see.
So there's certainly lots of mergers in the investment trust space or the broader investment companies. Do you think that some of these renewable companies will get together, merge, combine strengths? And if that happens, do you think that's a key sort of share price catalyst, or does it simply just make a bigger company that still remains out of favour?
So, if you're referring to the UK renewable energy investment companies, we haven't seen any of that so far. Although one of them, Octopus, last year said that it had been approaching another one, Aquila, with a view to a potential merger or some other tie-up. And I think that makes sense. By putting some of them together, if they have complementary portfolios, and those two companies certainly would, then you achieve a better diversification, both geographically and maybe across different subsectors like wind or solar. You improve the liquidity of the underlying stocks. I think some of these companies may be viewed as being slightly subscale. I'm not sure there's huge savings on offer. Maybe at the margin, but a lot of the costs, of course, are through the management fee. So maybe we can get some fee reductions as a condition of approving the merger, for instance. We have seen some corporate activity among the other companies that we invest in. So not the UK renewable energy investment companies, but some of the European renewable energy developers. And what I mean by that is these are companies not constituted as investment companies, but just normal corporates. And they do the development of renewable energy assets and then own and operate those assets. Whereas the UK investment companies, they tend to buy ready-made assets. So there's the distinction. So we've seen a few takeovers. Most recently, a large German-based, mainly solar but also wind, company called Encarvis has just received a bid from private equity. I saw one of my Spanish holdings last year, OPD Energy, go to a bid again from private equity. We haven't seen the oil companies come in and make any bids really, and not of any materiality anyway. Perhaps that's something that might happen. So yeah, we'll have to wait and see.
I mean, that's an interesting point actually about the oil companies, because they obviously go back a few years and they were very keen to show what they were doing with this transition to sort of the new era of energy. But then maybe in the last couple of years, they've pedaled back a bit and said, actually, we'll stick with some of the oil and gas assets for a while. But it must be inevitable that they're going to go sniffing around the sector looking for acquisitions, because surely it must be cheaper to buy someone else than to start from scratch, do you think?
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think the work they have done so far, like in the North Sea, for instance, that the prices they've paid for seabed leases, for instance, has been kind of higher than what I would have expected. So, you know, I guess for their size, it doesn't really make any difference to them. But yeah, they would, I think, be able to do it cheaper by acquiring other companies. And I think maybe part of the problem here is that you know, a number of these renewable energy companies like Ørsted or RWE or Northland Power, SSE, for instance, have been, you know, they've been developing a portfolio of assets to be built over the next 10 or 15 years for many years. And it's quite difficult to come in from scratch and replicate that. So I would logically expect to see some more corporate activity in future. But I think the oil companies, they found it all very difficult. So they may have kind of retreated back into their comfort zone for the time being.
Okay, that's all we've got time for in this episode. I hope you enjoyed the show. And we'll be back as normal later this week with the regular Money and Markets podcast. Until then, thanks for listening.
Before you go, please remember this podcast is for educational purposes. And the views expressed don't necessarily reflect those of AJ Bell or Shares Magazine. The podcast isn't telling you if a certain investment is suitable or not. Don't forget that the value of investments can change and you can lose money as well as make it. It's also important to remember that how you're taxed will depend on your individual circumstances and rules can change. The way an investment performed in the past may not be the same as how it behaves in the future. If you want help, go see a qualified financial advisor.